All right, let him in, Nicole.
Should I do the intro now?
Yeah, well, yeah. Go ahead and do the intro.
This is Live from the Table, recorded at the world famous Comedy Cellar, coming at you on SiriusXM 99 Raw Dog and on the Laugh Button Podcast Network. Dan Natterman here with Noam Dorman, the owner of the world famous Comedy Cellar, and Periel Aschenbrand, our producer. Though Noam has some issue with the use of that word. In any case, Periel is with us via Zoom from Greece. Hello, Periel.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Alan. How are
Well, would
you?
you not say hi, Alan, before I give him the introduction? You're kind of
Oh, I'm
spoiling the
sorry.
surprise.
Excuse me.
Go ahead,
Excuse me.
introduce him.
And with us once again is Alan Dershowitz.
Professor Alan Dershowitz.
He is a lawyer, a law professor, and author of over 40 books, both fiction and nonfiction, including seven bestsellers. And probably his most prestigious credit is I would say at this point, a regular on Live from the Table. He seems to, every time we ask him to come, he makes time for us. I'm not quite sure why. Whether he enjoys our discussions, I guess he must.
I do. I
Okay, good.
do. But
And
first, I start by correcting you. I just wrote my 50th book, not my 40th, The Price of Principle, Why Integrity is Worth the Consequences. And I'm working on 51. I'm turning 84 next week, and I hope at least another 10 books.
well, I think part of the reason you're so that you keep writing at 84 is the writing itself, I would assume, is good for your mind and good for your health, I would think.
Well, no, the major reason is because everybody's canceled me. I can't speak in the library in Chilmark. I can't speak at the 92nd Street Y. I can't speak in Temple Emmanuel. I can't speak in the Ramaz School. They've all canceled me. And the way to fight back against cancellation is to write books because you can't cancel books. Of course, the Chilmark Library, because I defended President Trump, decided not to carry any of my books for many years. They carried 20 of my books before I defended Trump, and then 9 of my books they refused to carry after I defended Trump. So, as Heinrich Heine once said, they start by burning books, they end by burning people. But before they start by burning books, they start by banning books. And imagine a library engaged in banning books and banning speakers. Can you imagine if a right-wing library in Texas decided that all pro-choice speakers are not going to be allowed and their books are not going to be shown? Every liberal in the country would be up in arms. And yet the liberals, the radicals, the left all support the library in this case. And they say, what the hell is Dershowitz doing? Threatening to sue a library because they won't let him speak and they won't carry his books? Imagine the principle that's going to establish if the libraries are allowed to do that.
Alan, I mean, about your book, what's your prognosis for the future? Do you expect the pendulum to swing back to a sweeter spot? Are you worried about the future?
It won't swing back naturally. We can help it swing, having shows like this, and having books like The Price of Principle may help push the pendulum, but it's not going to swing by itself. It's swinging in the wrong direction. The dangers today, the greatest dangers to democracy, are from academic, left-wing, hard-left professors and students because they are propagandizing the future leaders of America. They are not teaching. They're not teaching students how to think. They're propagandizing them as to what to think. And the pendulum isn't going to swing because 10 years from now, these propagandized students are going to be editor-in-chief of the New York Times, senior partner in Goldman Sachs, senator from New York, maybe a presidential candidate in 15 or 20 years. So the future looks very, very bleak. I worry about the right too, but the right is the past for the most part. The hard left is the future, the woke progressive hard left, the most regressive group since McCarthyism. They're the future. That's why we have something to worry about.
And also, before we get into other stuff, anything more you want to tell us about your book? Why we should read it? What's in
Well,
it?
it's an interesting book as it tells the stories. I mean, for example, I'm seated at a dinner party next to, of all people, Caroline Kennedy, the daughter of the former president of the United States, the man who wrote the book Profiles in Courage. And she says to me, if I knew you were invited, I never would have come to this event.
Oh.
she won't be in the same room with me. This is the ambassador to Australia who has to try to negotiate with the head of China, the head of North Korea, but she can't be in the same room with somebody that she previously invited to dinner at her home because she doesn't like the fact that I represented President Trump in front of the Senate. Imagine what she would say about John Adams if John Adams were sitting next to her at dinner. Oh my God, you represented the people accused of the Boston Massacre. I'll never have dinner with you again. So she had to go back and read Profiles of Courage, her father's book, and understand that it takes courage to represent unpopular people. And that's always been true of American history. Abraham Lincoln did it. Daniel Webster did it. Thurgood Marshall did it. And I don't want to compare myself to any of those giants, but I'm going to keep doing it till the day I die. I will defend the most unpopular people. The more you hate them, the more I'm likely to defend them.
You think that these conflicts give you something to get out of bed for in the morning? Do you think they keep you young in a certain way?
Yeah, I suspect so. I mean, you know, it's so interesting how it's worked, how McCarthyism has worked. I have to brag a little to make this point worth it. So when I was on the market to become a law school professor, I was like the combination of number one MBA, number one NFL, number one NHL choice. I was the guy. Every single law school in the country bid for me. There was a bidding war. Each one was bidding more than the other was bidding. Stanford was offering me this, and Berkeley was offering me this, Columbia. Today, I couldn't get a job in Joe's Law School in Bait Shop because I defended President Trump, even though I was obviously one of the most sought-after law professors. I taught 10,000 students, 50 years. But McCarthyism has trumped everything. And the Get Trump movement today, give you an example. My former colleague, Lawrence Tribe, who can get a job anywhere. Why?
I was just going to say that. He can get hired anywhere. Go ahead.
Yeah. He recently said that he was trying to persuade Attorney General Garland to prosecute Donald Trump for the attempted murder of Vice President Pence. Now, that may be the single dumbest thing a law professor has said in my lifetime. But because he said it, and because he's part of the Get Trump movement, he'd be invited to every library, every speaking event. Caroline Kennedy would hug him and kiss him and want to sit next to him, even though he has made some of the dumbest statements imaginable in an effort to try to get Donald Trump, and has trashed the Constitution, has trashed the Bill of Rights, has trashed the rule of law. Get Trump at any cost. That's what's going on. Look, I don't like. I voted against Trump twice. I'm looking for an opportunity to vote against him a third time if he runs. I'm not a Republican. I'm a liberal Democrat, but I'm a liberal Democrat who cares more about the Constitution than I do about partisan support for any party.
You know, I want to use this as a chance to get to the Trump thing in the documents, but you say you're a liberal Democrat.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you're aware of some of the programs that for the COVID relief. But, you know, they literally were handing out aid both to restaurants and to farmers, and they tried to do it with vaccines based on race. At what point does the Overton window shift so far that you have to rethink what it means to be a liberal Democrat or what it means, like the party's gone too far now? Did you ever think in your lifetime your party would be handing out disaster relief based on race and want to hand out life-saving medicine based on race?
But that's not what liberals do. I also wrote a book called The Case for Liberalism in an Age of Extremism. That's what radical woke people do. I hate the radical woke people even more than I don't like conservatives. And some of my conservative friends hate the extreme right. You ought to hate more on your side. You ought to be more opposed to people on your side than on people on the other side. It's too easy for a liberal to dislike a conservative. What's harder, what shows courage, I hope, is for liberals to stand up against radicals. I am opposed to race-based discrimination. I'm opposed to Harvard's admission policies, which favors blacks over Asians. I am opposed to Berkeley's house where only blacks can live in the house. And if a black person wants to bring his white father or white mother, they have to get special permission. Imagine if the shoe were on the other foot, if it were a white-only house. And in order for a black person to come, they'd have to get permission. No, we have to have one rule for everybody. And so I'm a strong opponent of many in the current Democratic Party. AOC is a great danger to liberty and democracy. The squad is a great danger to liberal democracy. Fortunately, AOC couldn't win a race outside of her district. She conceivably could win a mayoralty election in New York City. I doubt it, but she could. She couldn't come close winning a statewide election for the Senate or for a governor. And if she ran in the United States, she'd make Michael Dukakis seem like Ronald Reagan.
You know, I think I track your views on most things pretty closely. And given the what I foresee as the future of the Democratic Party's views on Israel, or the current views, with, you know, even Chuck Schumer refusing to tweet in favor of Israel during the Gaza war.
He's a total phony when it comes to Israel.
But I presume he's reading the polls, you know, of his party.
He's reading the polls, but look what happened during the Iran deal. He wouldn't commit himself. Finally, he got permission. He got permission from Barack Obama to oppose the deal because he knew there'd be enough people to support it. We're now thinking about bringing a lawsuit against President Biden by various senators who say that if a new Iran deal is entered into, it's a treaty. It's not a deal. It's a treaty. It looks like a treaty. It walks like a treaty. It quacks like a treaty. It's a treaty, and it needs two-thirds support in the Senate. And we're thinking hard about bringing such a lawsuit. And so it would be me bringing the lawsuit against the Democratic Party, which I'm happy to do.
If there's no Iran deal, what prevents them from, I mean, their breakout period is already like, what, 4 or 6 months? What will stop them if there's no longer a negotiated attempt?
Well, the deal won't stop them, that's for sure. The deal is a green light.
Right.
The only thing that will stop them is, and I like Biden's statement. I mean, he has said that he will not allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon, and he will take whatever actions are necessary, including implicitly military action. Look, I think the only thing that will stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons is the threat of a military strike. Sanctions don't work, making them a pariah in the committee. Just the other night, my family and I, we were at home and we watched the new Top Gun Maverick movie, which I liked very much. And of course, the whole plot is they have to attack the Iranian nuclear facility. They don't call it Iran, but they say an enemy that endangers our allies is about to go over the threshold. And so, you know, Top Gun has to go and on an impossible mission and destroy it. That may be what Israel has to do, and it may be what the United States has to do, but they're not going to do it through a phony deal. They're not going to do it through sanctions. They're not going to do it through United Nations resolutions. The Iranians just laugh at that.
So were you able to see Maverick at home, you said?
Yeah, it went on last night. Yeah, it went on last night.
Where's it streaming?
Cost me $20, but it was worth it. It was a good movie. Yeah.
I saw it in the theater because some movies I think you need to see in the theater. But
I do too, but with COVID, we're not going to theaters. So we'll have to watch it on a large TV.
Given the likelihood that the next Democratic president will probably be to the left of Joe Biden on everything, and Joe Biden, and given what you said, that it's going to take a credible American threat of a military action to deter Iran, doesn't that mean that you'd almost have to support the next Republican if this is, you know, on the top of your list of important issues?
Well, it's not my only important issue, but it's a very important issue. Very important, and I think it's a very important issue for America. And I have to tell you that I think it was Tom Friedman who said that Joe Biden may be the last Democratic candidate for president who's pro-Israel. You know, if they were to nominate Elizabeth Warren, if they were to nominate Bernie Sanders, I could not vote for any of them. But I find it hard to vote Republican. Why? I favor a woman's right to choose. I favor gay marriage. I favor reasonable gun control. I favor climate control. Those are all part of the Democratic agenda, not the Republican agenda. So like many people my age and many people of my political views, I'm a man without a country. I'm a man without a party. I'd love to see another Democratic nominee who was pro-Israel and centrist. I was an enthusiastic supporter of Biden for that reason, but I couldn't support people way to the left of Biden, particularly if the issue is if they don't support American strength, American exceptionalism, Israel. Those are important parts of what I what I vote for, what I vote for president.
So let me give you a chance to prove to the people who might be skeptical that you are actually a liberal Democrat. You had a podcast, it's already about at least 4 or 5 weeks ago already, where you surprised me that you gave a full-throated defense of Leah Thomas and trans women athletes being able to compete. You want to just give us an encapsulation of that view?
I found and I'll tell you, the disputes at my family table about that are amazing. I have two sons and a daughter and a wonderful wife with whom I've been married as of yesterday, 36 years.
Congratulations.
And my wife and my oldest son were totally opposed to my point of view. They basically said, look, this was a woman who was ranked 240th as a racer when she was a man. Now she's first in the world as a woman. It shouldn't be allowed. My other son, who is a sports lawyer, was strongly supportive of Thomas. For me, it's an extraordinarily difficult question. It's one of the hardest questions there is, just like abortion is a very, very hard question. The reason I ultimately err on the side, and it's a close question, I can be talked out of it, is if a person wants to live her entire life in a different gender, I think we should go out of our way to recognize it. And there's so much discrimination against transgenders that I'm prepared to say that it's okay with me if a woman who would ordinarily come in first comes in second and Thomas gets the gold medal. It's a bad thing. I don't like it, but I like it even less if we send a message to transgenders that we don't believe them. We don't really regard them as full women. I regard somebody who's transitioned from man to woman and, you know, really means it. Obviously, if we had a fake, if we had somebody who just decided to transition for 6 months to win championships and then went back, that of course that would be absurd. But if a person has really decided to live their entire life and we're committed that's true, I'm prepared to recommend. I'm not the one who's coming in second. I mean, the only medal I ever got, I'll tell you this story, the only medal I ever got is I was a very good track and field guy when I was a kid. And I was particularly good at something called a standing broad jump. They don't do that much anymore. I could jump over 6 feet, standing still and jumping. And so I was entered into this thing and I came back proudly. I was 12 years old, came back proudly with a bronze medal. And I showed it to my mother, my very cynical mother. She said, you got a bronze medal, huh? How many people were competing? I said, 3. So that was the closest I came to winning a really, really good medal. But you know, so I was third. And if a woman comes in second, that may be the price we have to pay. And it's a hard price.
Are you worried about it? I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead. Go ahead. Oh, are you worried about it backfiring? I mean, I can imagine the day that on TV, a trans woman just kicks the shit out of a cis woman in female boxing is the day that people are really going to turn against this. It's one thing to say fairness in, you know, in general, but when you see it, even with affirmative action, I think part of the reason it goes down easier because we never identify the actual black guy who got in.
I completely agree with you. I am totally sympathetic to that. Yeah. And I do think it can backfire. And I do think it's a hard question. And you may be right. And my wife and my older son may be right. I may be wrong on this. I don't usually admit that. But this is very hard. It comes from the gut for me. And the stories opposed to this are all anecdotal. And I'm in favor of a more systematic approach. I just want our country to announce we welcome transgenders. I have two friends who have grandchildren who transitioned and they have become very happy. They were very unhappy previously. And who am I to tell somebody that they can't achieve happiness with their own body? Now, I don't think 3-year-olds should be taught about transgenders or 5-year-olds, or they should be taught about, you know, sex at all. The limits of sex when you're 5 years old is I have to do a pee-pee. I don't want much more than that. You know, it's a hard question for me. And I am thinking with my heart, not with my brain on this one.
You know, it's funny because I was thinking in the car what I was going to say to you. I forgot to say it. I said I was going to say, Professor Dershowitz, I think that you're letting your heart get in front of your brain on this one. That's exactly what I was planning to say.
I know you're 100% right.
No, I don't think so. I think you're 100% right, Alan. I really do. I think that it's really the right way to go. And I think it's an important position to take, actually.
Well, Superior, what do you say? I want to ask you a question now. What do you say when the mother of the second place 19-year-old comes to you and says, my daughter was about to get a scholarship to Stanford as the best swimmer, and now she's been beaten and she's worked her whole life to win this scholarship, the whole life to finish first. She would have finished first, but this guy came along, became a woman, and now has affected my daughter terribly. What's your answer?
Well, my answer is, first of all, it's not a guy. That's number one. And number two is that, you know, sometimes we have to make concessions for the greater good.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think affirmative action taught us that. I'm a big fan of meritocracy. My colleague, Professor Sandel at Harvard, has written a book against meritocracy. I don't know what the alternative to meritocracy is. Let me tell you, when I really became a believer in meritocracy, exactly a year ago on my 83rd birthday, I had a gallbladder attack and I had to be rushed to New York. And so we got the first flight out, JetBlue. It was September 1st last year. If any of you want to check what happened on September 1st of last year, we had the worst storm in the Northeast in many years. And I was on the airplane with my
I almost died that night. Go ahead.
Right. I was on the airplane with my two sons, my two grandchildren, my daughter-in-law, and my wife. And the plane from Martha's Vineyard to New York is usually 35 minutes. This was about an hour and a half, and it was buffeting down, buffeting back and forth. And I had only one prayer. I hope this is not an affirmative action pilot. I want this pilot to be the most qualified, meritocratically selected pilot there ever was. And when I had surgery, I had the same view. I want my surgeon to be the best, but there's a great story. So I asked for the absolute best surgeon for one of my, I had a medical year to speak of in the last year, 6 procedures. So I needed one to be really good. And I asked everybody around and they all said the best person in the world is Carl Crawford. I hope he's listening. And I figure Carl Crawford, a 6'2" Brahmin, you know, handsome guy and white, obviously. And I get to the surgery and I meet my surgeon and he's a black kid from Brooklyn, not too far from where I was brought up, still had a Brooklyn accent. And I said to myself, wow, this is what meritocracy brings. And my view has always been true meritocracy will produce diversity. If you believe in equality, if you believe that all men and women are created equal, then a true meritocracy will produce diversity, not only racial diversity, but intellectual diversity and diversity of every kind. So I'm a big supporter of meritocracy. I wrote another book called The Case for Colorblind Equality in an Age of Identity Politics. So look, I write about every one of these controversial issues, and that's why I don't have too many friends.
So let me just answer Periel to some extent, and Alan, you can tell me if you disagree with me.
Sure.
I feel like the whole concept of women's sports is not exactly the mirror image of men's sports. It's actually created as a way to protect women. If we weren't trying to protect women, we would just have sports and men and women could all compete in the same. But we know no women would compete. No women would be able to compete. So we had to create a class for them, women's sports, so that they can compete on a fair playing field. And now we're going to take people who are genetically have a leg up, and the leg up might be significant because I don't know this, but just based on the very few women, transgender women competing in male sports, the number already that are winning and winning big implies to me, and it could just be anecdotal, that the advantage is quite significant. And perhaps even 20, 30 years from now, it's not ridiculous to think that all the track and field records will be held by transgender athletes. Mm-hmm. Then you're undermining the whole concept of why women's sports was created. No?
Yes, unless you define women more broadly.
And say, yes.
Look, I've been watching. I've been watching the WNBA. One of my sons is involved in the WNBA. These women are unbelievable. You know, I was a basketball player in high school. I was a varsity basketball player. I played in Madison Square Garden. I guarded a kid named Ralphie Lipschitz. You may have heard of him. He became Ralph Lauren. He wasn't a great ball player, but he really dressed well. But but I was a pretty good basketball player. I could never hold a candle to these women. I watched the other night, sadly, when the Liberty lost. But these ball players, these women ball players, now are far better than the college men that I knew when I was in college. You know, I think women are just going to get better and better and better and better. Will they ever be able to compete in weightlifting against men? Of course not. Will they be able to compete in other sports? I mean, there are some they can. What's my favorite sport? I can't remember the name of it. It's in the Olympics. You have Canadians playing curling? It a lot.
Curling?
Huh? Curling? Curling. Curling. Right. Now, that's a sport that women can do as well as men. Men. Why anybody would ever want to watch curling, I have no idea. But
well, you can imagine women shooting a basketball for accuracy.
Well, when you're visiting,
but not rebounding. Right?
When you're visiting your grandparents in Montreal, sometimes it's either curling or The Price is Right, and a couple of French channels.
But yeah, this you're right. By the way, women do have the person in professional basketball today, if I'm not mistaken, with the highest three throw average. Is a WNBA player who shoots around 95% free throws. I don't think any man today shoots into the 90s on free throws. But, you know, obviously you're right. When I was growing up, by the way, basketball was not a contact sport. You know, it was a sport of skills. If you wanted to do a contact sport, you went and played football. Today, basketball and football, you could hardly tell them apart with all the body contact. In fact, I'll tell you a story about that. Since we're into storytelling. So when I was a law clerk on the Supreme Court, we had a Friday afternoon game every week, and we played it in the fifth floor basketball court on top of the Supreme Court. It was called the highest court in the land because it was stories above the Supreme Court. And we would have law clerks playing, but one justice would play. And he was Byron White, who was known as Wizza White, who was an All-American football player for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And he simply didn't understand the difference between football and basketball. But this was back in 1964. He played basketball the way he played football. And I got more elbows in the mouth and in the eye from this guy. And I would scream out and yell, "Son of a bitch, Mr. Justice!" And he would say, "Hey, come on, it's all right. You can call me whatever you want." But you know, basketball back in those days were not regarded as a contact sport. And in those days, women probably could do as well as men, maybe not in rebounding with jumping. But my main point still with Periel is you got to make – we're at a stage in America where we have to make sacrifices to recognize the legitimacy of transgender activities. And I'm – again, close, hard, difficult question. But I'm on that side of it.
Go ahead.
Dan. We had a guest last week that suggested that the rise in people identifying as gay and bisexual
and trans
is at least in part due to societal acceptance and maybe even that society can influence somebody's sexuality. When you were growing up, when did you first even know there was such a thing as trans people?
I didn't know there was such a thing as gay. When I was growing up, are you kidding? We used the terrible word, which I won't even say here, the F word, to describe kids who weren't good athletes. We didn't know what gay people were growing up, but you were an F person if you weren't a good athlete. We didn't know anything about that. Transgender would be, you know, that would be something that you would expect maybe to see at the sideshow in the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. But you never understood that there were real people with, you know, I love the speech from Merchant of Venice. If you prick us, do we not bleed? That was stated by a Jew, but the same thing could be stated by a transgender person, by a gay person, by people who were ostracized and marginalized, and transgender people are still marginalized, and I want to bring them closer to the mainstream. And if it turns out that people are willing to become transgender because society makes it easier to do, I don't think that's a criticism. I think that's a good thing.
Perry, when were you first made aware of transgender?
When I was in high school.
Was there somebody in your school, a student that was transgender?
No, but I used to, we did have one friend who went to Forest Hills High School. I went to private school and they went to public school, and they sort of hung around with some friends. And I used to take the subway in from Queens to go to all the nightclubs. And there were a lot of drag queens and trans
women. We don't say
women.
Drag queens anymore.
Well, no, I know drag queens is a separate category. We do say drag queens.
We do?
Yeah, because that's a separate category.
No, don't give me gender.
I grew up in Greenwich Village, so I always knew about this stuff. And my grandmother, for some reason, was always fascinated by it. Who was like the first famous?
It was Renee Richards.
Renee Richards. There was somebody in one of those.
But even before Renee Richards, I may have had the first legal case involving transgender. It was in the middle 60s. I was a young assistant professor at Harvard, and I spent most of my time in the law school library because I was just writing away article after article trying to get tenure. And one of the people who brought me books all the time, a really nice librarian, suddenly got fired because he was transitioning into she and was beginning to wear a skirt and beginning to develop breasts. And the librarian, the chief librarian, said, "We can't have our students upset that way." So they fired I can't say he, or although he and she were very important, because the lawsuit I threatened to bring was, you hired him as a man, you're firing him as a woman. That's sex discrimination. And we won the case. Now, all she wanted to do was earn enough money and have enough insurance so she could go to Denmark. Because in those days, the only country, Christine Jorgensen, remember, the only country that was allowing doing that was in Denmark. And so the agreement that was finally reached with the library, and this time I didn't even think about this for the last 55 years, was the agreement for the library in those days. I wouldn't make that agreement today, is that she would keep her job, and she agreed to this, but she would work in the stacks in the back of the library and not deal directly with students who would be upset. She was okay with that. She worked in that position for a few years, made enough money, had enough insurance, and then went off to Denmark. And I don't know what happened after that. But so I had one of the first of those cases. And for me, it was eye opening. And, the person I represented was just the nicest, sweetest person in the world. And I just was so happy I could help him become her.
You know, and then I'll move on. I have a very, very, very close friend, Perry Ellen Dan, know her, who spent her whole life as a man. And then in her 50s, and by the way, it was not a story of having always felt that way, but only in the late 40s began to have these feelings, but now has transitioned to a woman. And, we're very, very close still. And she knows I disagree with her about some of this stuff. She knows I don't really agree with her about the sports and things like that, but she's fine with it. And but she's much, much happier. And I'm so happy that she's able to live this life now, the only time in history, maybe, where she actually can go out in the world totally as who she is, at least in New York.
Yeah.
And have a satisfaction in life, you know.
But people are accusing me of transitioning. They say I'm transitioning from being a liberal to a conservative, from being a Democrat to a Republican. I'm not. And but life is full of transitions. And, if you're like me, you don't believe that people are born by God's will with certain genders. But, we have control over our own lives. And I just think we ought to encourage people to be themselves. But I agree, it's a very, very, very difficult question. Look, I think abortion is a very difficult question. At the extremes, it's easy. Of course, a woman should have the right to abort a 1 week, a 1 day, a 1 month fetus. And of course, a woman should probably not have the right to abort a 9-month fetus that could easily be removed and be viable and be given up for adoption. Right. And the question is, you know, going to be a matter of degree. I've written about this a lot. You know, Florence Kennedy, who was a great feminist advocate for a woman's right to have an abortion, used a horrible analogy. She said, removing a fetus is like removing an appendix. No, it's not. Nobody ever regretted having an appendix removed. An appendix is not potential life. The decision to terminate a pregnancy, particularly in the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth month, is a dramatic, difficult decision. And for those people who believe that the fetus at a certain stage is life and has a soul, it must be the most heart-wrenching thing imaginable. So I think gay rights are the simplest issue in the world. Interracial marriage, simplest issue in the world. There's no other side to that. Contraception, easiest issue in the world, because these are rights without victims. But when you get to abortion, it's much harder because half the world believes there is a victim. The vast majority of people believe that there's a victim at a certain stage, not in others. The interesting thing is that the reversal, the overruling of Roe versus Wade, is apparently helping the Democrats. As I predicted it would in 1973, when Roe versus Wade came down, I said, other than the women who have the right to abortion, the biggest beneficiaries of this are going to be Republicans. And I also predicted that if it were to be overruled, the biggest beneficiaries would be Democrats. Because when you make it a political issue, the vast majority of Americans want to see a woman have a right to have an abortion, at least at a certain point. And so if that becomes a referendum, as it did in New York in one of the races, as it did in Kansas, we're going to see the anti-abortionists, the right-to-life extremists, lose in most parts of the country. Not in every part of the country, but in most parts.
I agree. On another matter, two things real quick. Did you see the news story? I wish I could remember the details. Some state where apparently 1 year, they rescinded it this year. They had, in high school, they were teaching the Holocaust, but they forbid the use of the word Nazi because akin to the N-word in a racial context, they thought it'd be too upsetting for the Jews to hear the word Nazis. Did you hear this story?
I never heard that story, but let me tell you. As a Jew, I'm not upset when we talk about Nazis.
Well, and finally, the Jews in the district complained and said, no, it's okay to use the, I mean, N-word's already taken, but the Nazi word, you know.
But you know, Noam, I suspect you know at least a word of Hebrew or two.
Yeah.
When we grew up, if you ever said the word Hitler, it had to be followed by Yimach Shemo, which means in English, may his name forever be erased. So you could say Hitler, but you had to say after that, may his name be erased. I don't want it to be erased. I want everybody to understand what Hitler did and what the Holocaust was about, and that it was perpetrated not only by Nazis, but by Germans who were not Nazis, who stood idly by. The only thing to guarantee that evil will succeed is for good people to say nothing, as Burke said, and as others have said over the years. So, yeah, let's teach about Nazism. Let's teach about racism. But let's make sure we use the term properly. America is not a systemically racist country. I have a chapter in my book, The Price of Principle, about why America is not a systemically racist country. We are a systemically anti-racist country with pockets of racism that have to be dealt with. But the systemic aspect of our country is anti-racist. And so we have to recognize that progress has been made.
Yeah, when I think about teaching the Holocaust without the use of the word Nazi or without images of the camps or whatever it is, it makes me think that maybe the total moratorium on the use of the N-word is actually making it harder for people to viscerally understand what it is they're learning about.
Especially when you use it to make a point.
Yes.
My friend, Randy Kennedy, is a professor at Harvard, wrote a book. He's black. He wrote a book with the title of the book was not the N-word, but the actual word spelt out. And he provoked it. I'll tell you another interesting story. Some of you may remember there was a great case in the United States Supreme Court. It was called Collins versus the United States, in which a young anti-war demonstrator had worn into court a jacket that had the words F, and then the letters after that, the draft. And so when the case came to be argued in front of the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice had the marshal tell the lawyer for Cohen not to use the F word in the court, that it would be It would demean the dignity of the court. We all know the justices said what the word is, just don't use it. And as soon as this guy walked into court, he said, may it please the court, fuck the draft. I've said it. The nation hasn't fallen. We're all going to survive. And what he has said is that if he hadn't said that word, and if he had accepted the notion of the Chief Justice, it would have helped the other side's argument that it was an improper word. But he said it, and he said it loudly. Nothing happened. The pillars didn't crumble, and he won his case.
All right. Tell us about the Trump documents.
We'll know a little bit more. So just a couple of hours ago, the magistrate judge ruled that the redacted affidavit had to be released, but he made a very serious mistake. Now, I haven't seen what's been redacted. Nobody has. But in his order, which I've read carefully, he said that he is going to redact the strategy of the case. No, he shouldn't do that. He should redact the names of confidential informants. He should redact the names of witnesses who might feel intimidated. Yeah, but not the strategy or the theory of the case. We're entitled to know what the theory of the case is. Are they going after Trump on violation of the Espionage Act of 1917, the most hated statute by liberals until now when it's being used against Trump? We have a right to know that. So it seems to me from what I've seen is that Reinhardt, who I generally like and think well of, probably has agreed to over-redact the affidavit.
Let me ask for another question first. This may be stupid, but it occurred to me that currently, virtually any document I ever see is not the only copy of that document. Everything is generated from a computer. And I was thinking, what are the odds that any document that Donald Trump has in his box, there is not another copy of on a White House server somewhere, on a White House computer somewhere, because they can't give him, a document can get coffee spilled on it. Anything important can't happen. Yeah.
No, I think you're right. I think you're generally right. Look, there was allegedly a handwritten letter from the head of North Korea. I don't know. That might have one copy.
Yeah.
I get a warrant for that. Most of it will have multiple copies. That's why, you know, there are no secrets anymore. Eventually, pretty much everything comes out. I'm still shocked that we haven't seen, to quote Woody Allen, the nonfiction version of the Warren Report. Because I still think there's some things to be disclosed back now, 60 or so years. I'm not completely confident. You know, I was asked to serve as a young lawyer on the Warren Commission by Earl Warren himself. And my Justice Goldberg, told me not to do it because he said this won't be an honest report. We already know the conclusion that Warren was appointed by Lyndon Johnson to make sure that no one would blame the shooting of Kennedy on the Russians or the Soviets, because otherwise we'd go to war. And so the conclusion was determined before the Warren Commission was set up. And I think the report itself leaves much to be desired. It's very possible the conclusion is correct, but the process was not a good one.
And what does that lead you to believe about this whole Trump matter with the documents? You're skeptical. You think it's political at root, but for the political pressure, would this still have happened?
No, I think this is part of the goal to make sure that Trump doesn't run again. The goal is to get him indicted on a crime.
It's important to interrupt you there. You mean explicitly Garland says to himself, I want to make sure Trump doesn't run again? Or is this just bias, which is so deep within him, he doesn't understand it himself?
Well, I don't think it's Garland. I think these decisions are being made by lower ranking zealots within the Justice Department and the FBI. You know, for example, people like Strzok, do you remember emails came out? We have to make sure that Trump isn't elected. We have to have an insurance policy. There's a lot of that. Look, I live on Martha's Vineyard for the summer, and the people here, particularly those who aren't talking to me, which is most of them, they really believe Trump is Hitler, and they really believe I'm Goebbels or Goering. They think of me as a Nazi war criminal for having enabled President Trump. And that's how strongly they feel about it. They'll do anything to stop Trump from running. I think they don't realize that if Trump runs against Biden, Biden wins again, no matter how old he is. Trump cannot beat Biden, but DeSantis could beat Biden. And so if you're a Republican, I'm not sure the best interests of your party is going to be served by having Trump run. And there are a lot of Republicans who understand that, but there are also a lot of zealots among Republicans who, you know, who will take up arms if Trump is indicted. And you know, look, if Trump were to be indicted under the Nixon standard, you know, Nixon smoking gun, Republicans wanted him indicted. Republicans wanted him impeached. He wasn't impeached because the Democrats wanted him as impeached. He was impeached because the leaders of the Republican Party came to him and said, "We're voting against you. You better resign." Unless that standard is met on Trump, and it's not even close to being met at the moment, I think we're going to have even greater division than we have now. And I think Garland knows that. And so I don't think that he is one of those who is trying to get Trump. Of course, he'd love to make sure Trump doesn't run, but I don't think he is prepared to distort the law the way Lawrence Tribe is.
You know, I was just Googling. I was in Martha's Vineyard one time on a bike trip one summer as a youth in 1982, I believe it was. And I remember the only thing I remember is Mad Martha's ice cream. And
still good. It's just bought by a new guy, but it's still very good. And I still about once every 2 weeks can afford weight wise to get a Mad Martha. So I love
the first place I ever had cookies and cream. It was called just Oreo ice cream at that time.
Yeah. But there was a fake ice cream that they used to advertise. Of course, never happened, but there was usually a sign, lobster ice cream. Never happened, but that was the joke. Look, Martha's Vineyard, probably the best illustration of Martha's Vineyard is I'm sitting on the porch, and this is the story is in my book, The Price of Principle. I'm sitting on the store of the Chilmark porch, which I used to, the porch of the Chilmark store, which I have lunch a few times a week. I had lunch today with my son there. And who comes by? Larry David. You know, Larry was an old friend of mine. I helped get his daughter into college. He used my gym as a place to work out. We had dinner three times a summer every year, maybe more. We would have dinner when I went to Los Angeles. He starts screaming at me. I say, "Larry, can't we talk?" "No, we can't talk. You're disgusting. You're disgusting. All of you are disgusting. We can't talk." I thought he was going to have a stroke. I mean, his veins were bulging. What did I do wrong? I patted Mike Pompeo on the back. He was my former student. And I was congratulating him for the great work he had done in the Middle East on the Abraham Accords and on other things. I would do it again today. But for Larry David, that was enough to terminate a friendship and a relationship and to call me disgusting in front of a whole bunch of people. Ironically, the guy I was having lunch with is way, way, way to the left of Larry David, way to the left of me. And he loves me. And you know, he disagrees with me. We fight all the time, but he's not part of the Chilmark crowd. The Chilmark crowd is the most intolerant group of people I have ever met. Look, some of them you can excuse. There are a lot of them that are just too stupid to understand the difference between representing somebody and supporting them. That's particularly true of people who are the kind of spouses, both men and women, spouses of the very rich and famous people. And, you know, they're the people who come along and think they were hit a triple because they were born or married on third base. But so there are some who are just too stupid to understand, but others understand. And they're just old fashioned McCarthyites in a new garb. And so that's why I wrote my book, The Price of Principle, to expose that, to tell the stories, to name names, to point fingers. I'm not going to cover up for them. I'm not going to protect them. They're engaging in horrible, horrible behavior. One of the reasons Donald Trump is having such a hard time getting a lawyer, a really, really, really first-rate lawyer. He has some good lawyers. A bunch of lawyers who are really first-rate called me and said, "I won't go near him after what happened to you, after the way you've been treated. My God, I wouldn't take his case for anything." Yeah,
they'll defend Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a second, in a heartbeat.
Without a doubt. And in fact, the ACLU was so active in defending terrorists. Yeah. And they haven't said a word about the search of Mar-a-Lago. They haven't said a word about denial of free speech on the left. The ACLU is now the Anti-Civil Liberties Union. If you want to join a good organization, join FIRE, the Freedom of Individual Responsibility and Education.
Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. I'm friendly with Greg Lukianoff. Look,
he's great.
I don't want Trump to get away with anything, and I don't want the nation's secrets exposed. But I try to sometimes imagine if the health of my child were tied to what's best for the United States of America, what policy would I support, you know? And I just cannot imagine it being better for America to go through a trial of Donald Trump, and then the risk that he gets off and the fire that would start then, you know. Just, I cannot, it's very hard for me to foresee any scenario where I think a purely patriotically minded person would want to see the nation dragged through this in the way that Gerald Ford, history seems to have borne him out, although my father never forgave him for pardoning Nixon.
I had dinner with Gerald Ford not long after that happened, and he said the two most important decisions in his life were pardoning Nixon, which cost him the election, of course, and appointing to the Supreme Court Justice Stevens, who became quite liberal. So, you know, he was a lot more centrist than people think. So, yeah, look, if Trump were to be indicted, he'd be convicted in the District of Columbia. You'd be convicted in the District of Columbia. I'd be convicted in the District of Columbia. If anybody knew we had anything to do with Trump, it's 91% Democrat in the District of Columbia, the most heavily Democratic political unit in the United States. But it would probably be reversed on appeal. But by that time, it would take a long time in the country. Would be really, really divided in two. It would not be a vindication of the Justice Department if he got convicted. As I used to say about, a grand jury indicting somebody, a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich, particularly if my grandmother were on it, but any grand jury would indict a ham sandwich because they indict anybody who comes before them. And the same thing is true of a District of Columbia jury. They very rarely acquit.
I remember serving on a grand jury years ago here in New York, and they gave us like a booklet about all the things we could do as grand jurors. We could ask to see the scene of the crime. I mean, it was a whole book of things. We had to read it on our own because they didn't. And so some of us took that seriously and tried to be proactive. And they brought in the DA brought in like a higher up DA to basically read us the riot act and saying we were like, just to behave ourselves, basically.
Stop it. You're 23 chairs. You're not jurors. You're chairs. 23 chairs. And if 12 of the 23 chairs vote for indictment, it's going to happen. And they always do. And by the way, if the first grand jury doesn't indict, you go to a second grand jury and a third grand jury. But they always indict. So prosecutors can get anybody indicted. My friend Harvey Silverglate, who was one of the founders of FIRE, wrote a great book called Three Felonies a Day, showing how with the very expansive criminal laws that we have in the book, especially the Espionage Act of 1917, almost every busy person or complex person commits about three felonies a day. And it's always up to the prosecution to decide which ones to prosecute. And, you know, they treated Sandy Berger and Hillary Clinton, both of whom are my friends, who I like very much, a lot less aggressively than they seem to be treating Donald Trump for the mishandling of classified material.
I have a question about that. Am I wrong about this? So there's one thing that interests me about Donald Trump, although he may not have done it properly. He did have the ability to declassify anything he wanted, as opposed to Hillary Clinton, who absolutely did not.
That's all true.
So to me, is there in some way, is this a procedural crime on the part of Donald Trump? Simply, he didn't do the paperwork properly. Not that he had no way to do it.
You don't need to do the paperwork. It's reported that President Bush the first, I think it was, declassified some material in the middle of a meeting, just by saying, all right, let's declassify that and we can continue to have the discussion at the meeting. But it's a question of proof. I mean, what Trump can't do is say, oh, I wanted to declassify it, but I didn't do it until I left the office. You can only do it until January 20th. And I think he would have the burden, for certain purposes at least, of demonstrating that he actually did declassify it.
Right. He would. I get that. But I'm just saying it's in some way, nevertheless, it is still different in my mind because he didn't do it. but he could have done it. He just
and maybe he did do it. Maybe
for Hillary. Hillary never had that option. She's an employee. He's the guy making the rules. So it's, well, it's not two sides of the same coin.
No, I agree. I think were to be changes in law, I think we ought to not allow a president just to declassify or classify everything. I think there ought to be a process put in place where there is a paper record of classification or declassification. But that doesn't apply to this particular alleged crime. Right. That has to be judged by what the rules were at the time. And at the time, the rules were a president could orally declassify.
But were you saying, by the way, earlier that Hillary is a friend of yours? You're saying that of all the people that have defriended you, she is not one of them.
No, she was a friend. I have no idea. I haven't seen her now. I can tell you this, that she spoke at an event on Martha's Vineyard. It was the Jewish Democratic Council of America. And I was disinvited. I either wasn't Jewish enough or Democratic enough. Or American enough, but I was not invited. She spoke at it. I don't know whether she was aware that I was not invited. So I don't know whether she's still a friend or not. I can tell you Bill Clinton, the last time I saw him, was very friendly to me. And Sandy Berger, of course, died a few years ago, but he was very friendly to me. But right these days, I have no idea who my friends are because there's a cabal on Martha's Vineyard of people. And if they see anybody talking to me, they become part of the group that are now condemned. And so a number of these hypocrites on Martha's Vineyard have said, we're happy to have dinner with you, but don't tell anybody. And I refuse all the time to have dinner with anybody who won't be seen with me in public.
I think this is the last question, unless Dan has something, but I'm just curious because you actually know these people. Is it true that the Clintons had a sincere transition, as you were saying before? They seem to have come into office, when was it, 88 or 92?
92.
Skeptical of Israel, kind of sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. Hillary got in some trouble for some remarks she made back then. And they seem to have gone out of office truly, truly with warm feelings towards the Israeli nation and the Israeli people.
Well, I can tell you that's absolutely not true of Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton came to office loving Israel, always was supportive of Israel. I've had numerous discussions with him. Once I remember sitting at a dinner table with him and a Jewish friend of mine started attacking Netanyahu. And Bill and I started to respond and Bill hit me on the knee and said, let me take this. And he did. I think Hillary Clinton, you may be right. I think she came from a somewhat more lefty, progressive background, Wellesley, you know, Wellesley, when she was there, still had a quota against Jews. By the way, there's an interesting fact. In about 1990, I was, maybe it was a little earlier, I was chairman of the Civil Rights Division of the Anti-Defamation League, and we had a report about schools that still had anti-Jewish quotas. Guess what they had in common? Guess what every school in those days that had an anti-Jewish quota had in common? Ariel, you're not going to like this.
I'm listening.
They were all women's colleges. Wellesley, Smith, Holyoke. I forget the others. But the only remaining schools. Why? Because there were two groups that dominated in all women's colleges. Kind of the old Brahmin, old-fashioned anti-Semites who never liked Jews, and the young radicals who have started not to like Jews. So those were the only schools. Now, they've given them up now a long time ago, but when Hillary was at Wellesley, it had an anti-Jewish quota.
Okay, Professor Dershowitz.
Well, my only question, my one last question is, you know, you're getting the cold shoulder in Martha's Vineyard. You're being berated by Larry David. Are you staying there because you just love it so much, or you're trying to make a point and saying, F you, I'm not going anywhere?
Well, it's a combination. They're not going to make me leave. You know, I came to this island 53 years ago to defend not a Republican, but to defend Ted Kennedy. I got a call from Ted Kennedy's chief of staff saying that the senator's driven off a bridge. Get to the vineyard. I didn't know what the vineyard was. I got to the vineyard, hated it the first time I was there. Then I fell in love with it. I like it very much. We just have new friends. We don't have anything to do with the Chilmark crazies. And so, you know, we're going to stay here. But it's not, it's, you know, my wife didn't want me to represent Trump, but she's being attacked. She's being criticized. She's being ostracized. She was in a gym and some woman said, oh, that's Alan Dershowitz's wife. I can't be in the same room with her, and left. I mean, we have not been invited to memorial services for friends. And we were invited to an engagement party. And then we got a letter saying, we have to disinvite you because if you showed up, half the people would leave. So, you know, that's what's going on. And they take it out of my wife. They take it out of my children. And, you know,
do I recall
about it in the price of principle?
Yes.
Do Nicole, I recall that? Hold on. Do
Nicole,
I recall?
Can you pull up the link on Amazon to show Professor Dershowitz's book?
Okay. Alan, do I recall that there was some similar story to that when you were defending OJ, that in your shul, the people walked out?
But not nearly as bad. Not nearly as bad. This is 10 times worse than OJ.
Well, OJ only beheaded some people. I mean, sorry.
This is much worse than Tyson, much worse than anything else. But look, I have a thick skin. I will endure. My family, they're unfairly being attacked. But when the library won't have me, the real victim then are the people in Schulmark who want to hear me or want to read my books. And that's intolerable. And that's what I will really, really fight back against. Hey, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
I'm gonna let you go. I want to tell you something. You know, today I was taking a shower and I turned 60 years old a few weeks ago, and I'm bothered by being 60. And I'm thinking to myself, boy, I hope that I can have as many vital years in front of me as friggin' Alan Dershowitz does. It's just remarkable to me. And I would like to put in a reservation today to have you on your 100th birthday on our podcast.
But you know, the Jewish tradition is you should live till 120. So let's make it the 120th birthday.
Okay.
But whenever I wish people you should live to 120, I always say in a few months, God forbid you should die on your birthday. So all of us till 120. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, Alan.
I always love this. Can't wait to get back to New York and be in the basement and listen to some great comedy. Please.
Price of Principle by Alan Dershowitz, available on Amazon. And
let Alan go. And I want to make fun of Periel for a few minutes.
Thank you. Bye, Alan.
This is what's interesting,
Periel. I like that you think by putting up a 70 character link on a YouTube video that's going to help our listeners go to the Amazon link. I think all they need is the name of the book.
First of all,
put up a link, Nicole. Our customers are. What? Go ahead.
First of all, you know what? Can you just host the show and let me do the things that people ask me to do? He asked me to do something of that nature. And you know what? It didn't bother anybody but you. And also, I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Oh, brother. Okay.
Periel, hope you're enjoying Greece. We'll see you back, I guess, next week. It's hard to believe it's September almost already. Already almost September. It goes just too fast.
Why did summer go so quickly? Was it something that I said? You know, that's
I don't know what that's for.
Windmills of my mind.
Oh, round, that's like a French thing?
Like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel. That's it.
Thank you, everybody. Please, podcast at comedyseller.com. Let us know. I mean, we're a little as a podcast. We know it. Sometimes
I got to tell you guys, I got invited as a thought leader and a podcast host by the government of Israel for a 6-day tour.
A 6-day tour. Well, OK, great. We'll talk about that. We can't wait to hear about it. When's that going to happen?
It's November.
Well, we'll talk about it more as it gets closer, I suppose. Should I close this out now?
Yes, please do.
Podcast at comedyseller.com. We know we're a bit all over the place. One week it's Alan Dershowitz. One week we're talking about stand-up. You know, one week something else. Please help us focus on what you want to hear the most. Or maybe you like us being a little bit all over the place. I don't know. We don't know. We can't read your mind. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Periel. Enjoy the rest of your time in Greece. I know it's always hard to leave a beautiful place like Greece, but we do look forward to seeing you back here.
Yasu, Kalinik.
And of course, a special thanks to our wizard, our audio sorceress, Nicole Lyons, all the way coming to us from Binghamton, New York. She lives in New York now, but her heart is still in Binghamton.
Wrap it up, then.
Okay, bye-bye.